end of Sefer Avadia. Winding down on Sefer Avadia, soon will be Yoina. Okay, let's see. Pasuk off. Pasuk, we're on page 396. Thank you very much for the coffee. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Shakol Nihyeh Bidvarayim. Okay, up to page 396. Ha'al Pasuk off. V'golus Hachel Hazel Levnei Yisrael Asher Kenanim Asher Kenanim Ad Sarfas. The exile. Okay, we're going to over here. This exile, which will begin now for the Jewish people, Asher Kenanim Ad Sarfas, the Golus. Now we have to. We'll see in a few moments what we mean by this from the Kenanim. Who live? Okay, it's referring to the place where they live. They live in the region where the Canaanim, the ancient Canaanim, used to live, all the way until Tsarfas, and that's another region. The Golus Yerushalayim Asher Bisforad, and the Golus of Yerushalayim. Now, why here are we calling Yerushalayim the people of Sepharad? Okay, that's not what we normally refer to Yerushalayim. Okay, we'll hold off for one moment. Yirshu Eis Orei HaNegev. They will inherit the Orei HaNegev. Now let's see this pasuk inside the Mitzudos David, more understanding. Pasuk Chaf, page 396 in the Mitzudos David. V'golus Achel Hazeh B'mikwa Shalafon of Nemar Shebeis Yaakov Yirshu Eis HaNegev. In the previous pasuk we learned last week, pasuk Yitas, we learned that Klal Yisrael is going to inherit different parts of either Eretz Yisrael or different parts of the world. We have different perushim as to what the pasuk refers to, but it basically means that the Jewish people in the times of Mashiach, when they will conquer the nation of Edom, will expand. Their reach will go further. So here it's coming to tell us that this that we said in the previous pasuk, that Beis Yaakov Yirshu HaNegev, Yiforish Ata Mi V'mi Mehem Yiyu HaYarshim. According to the Mitzudos, pasuk Chav is nothing more than an explanation of pasuk Yotes. Who will be the people? Who is the subject of Pasuk Yutes? Pasuk Yutes began with the word V'yarshu. They will possess. They will inherit. Who's they? So Pasuk Chaf is telling us who the they are. The people who went into exile. Mi v'mi yiyu hayarshim. V'yamar b'nei ha'goyla. And the answer is, the b'nei ha'goyla shel ha'chayil, shel ha'chil, hazeh, shel b'nei Yisrael. It's the exiles of this chel. Chel normally means the army, but here refers to this multitude, Shal B'nei Yisrael, Yarshvu im HaKananim, they will inherit, im HaKananim Shebarchum Yartzam B'mei Yehoshua, they will inherit, together with the Kananim, who ran away from their land, B'mei Yehoshua, Asher Mikoy Moishavam Ad Sarfas, and their place extends all the way to Tsarfas. Now, where is Tsarfas? We don't really know, but it's far, far away. The Jewish people who once upon a time occupied Yerushalayim, who are now currently in Sepharad. Where is Sepharad? We do not know. You want to tell me that Spain? Possible, but not you can't prove that to be correct. Heim Yirshu or Eis Ori HaNegev. Who har Esav, Eretz Edom, they're going to possess the land of Edom. Aval Eretz Pelishtim v'stoyis Ephraim v'shoymer mehem v'srech v'ulei Eretz Yisrael v'yichulak achar kach k'moshek o'shenemar b'sof Yecheskel. That is not part of the discussion here in this passage. So in general, what is he coming to say over here? He's coming to say something very, saying that the Jewish people who were exiled to just like the Canaanim. Now, I'm not really certain what it means, but he adds here the word im b'nei Yisrael asher yoshu im ha'kananim shebaruchu mi'artzam b'mei Yehoshua asher mikoy moishavam ad sarfas. He seems to be saying here something very interesting, that Klal Yisrael, at the time of the Churban, Churban Bayis Rishon, and maybe even the loose the Churban Bayis Sheni, their path of exile was similar to the exile of the Canaanim. What we did to the Canaanim was done to us.
Didn't we destroy them rather than exile them?
Good question. We are under the assumption that the Canaanim no longer exist today. Well, we said that they're the Pelishtim. Yeah, but he's saying over here, he's saying that it's like Mida Kineged Mida. We went and we drove out the Canaanim. So Mida Kineged Mida, the same thing that happened to them happens to us. So right away you'll say, how could you say such a thing? That's Epicurus. The reason why we have the right to drive out the Canaanim is because Hashem told us, and that's the first Rashi in the Torah. The first Rashi in the Torah addresses how are the Jewish people allowed to take possession of a land that seemingly is not theirs. The Umay Sa'ola will say to Klal Yisrael, Listim Atem, you are thieves, you are bandits, you are occupiers. You're taking possession of a land that does not belong to you. And we know this to be the case, unfortunately, we know this to be, that's the argument they've been making against us for time immemorial. What are you doing? And what is the answer? The only real answer is because it's Hashem's world, and Hashem gave it to us. Hashem is the landlord, and the landlord has a legal right to break the lease, to cancel the lease with a tenant who is in violation of the terms. If you are an owner of property, and you have a tenant, and the tenant is destroying your property, the tenant is doing illegal activity in your property, then by all means, you have 100% permission to evict the tenant, period, and to bring into the building, into the apartment, whoever you deem fit, you seem fit. So that's the only answer. That's really the only answer that Chazal tells that we can legitimize the fact that we have taken possession, we have waged a war, and come into Eretz Yisrael and take over the land is because Hashem, when He created the world, He gave the land to the Canaanim. The Canaanim have misbehaved. They have become idolaters, pagans. They worship idols. They do terrible chazal. The psukim describe to us the abominations that they have committed in the land that are beyond description. To take their own children and to pass them in fire and to burn them and things like that along those lines and to outright deny Hashem's existence. They have broken the lease. They have broken the condition upon which they were given the land, and therefore Hashem is within His legal right to evict them and to give the land to those who He deems fit to be, and that is Klal Yisrael, who have accepted the Torah. When everything comes down to it, that's the only true reason why we have a right to Eretz Yisrael. And fortunately, you know, this is a very big sticking point. Today the Goyim, this is like a real controversial topic. The Goyim are saying to us in the last who knows how long, Listim Atem, your occupiers, this land has been the territory, the property of the Arabs or the Christians, whoever you want to go look at it, for the last 2,000 years. And don't tell us what happened 2,000 years ago. We don't want to know from that. We only want to know from the way it is right now. And you have all the laws of Chazaka. You know, the Klal Yisrael in Masechta Bava Basra, if the Baal HaBayis, he abandoned his property, there's something called, there are certain rules. There are certain rules that apply. So the Goyim say there's a certain set of rules that apply, and you do not have right to come and take possession of Eretz Yisrael. So in the news, in the media, what do we answer? Well, the United States took possession of America. They took it away from the Indians. They took it away from whoever was living here. Why? Because there's war. There are rules of war, and there are things that the way the world runs. And if you start up with someone and you punch them in the face, they have a right to punch you back and knock you out and take away your property.
I never thought that was a good approach.
Right, but that is an approach.
That's a two wrongs don't make a right.
But that you hear that all the time in the news, and then you'll hear in the news all the different reasons. They give a long list. You'll always hear about this every time this is discussed. That the Jews have, look, we do the But what is the response? What is the response to why we are not considered occupiers? So there's a gamut, a whole long laundry list of reasons that we really do have possession. Look at all of the proof that once upon a time was ours. You couldn't get this war. In war, we won it legally, like every other country. I don't remember all the reasons, but there are a long, long list of reasons. Problem is, these reasons have flaws. They really all do, and they're not good answers for the other countries of the world as to why they are legally permitted to live in their land.
I think they're good answers, they're just not interested.
That's for sure they're not interested. That's a given they're not interested. But that's for sure. If someone doesn't like you...
international law, decide double standards, decide all these other things.
Correct.
They're all valid points.
Even if we are 100%... Exactly. That's a mitzvah in life. You can be 100% correct. If someone doesn't like you, someone hates you, they just ignore the facts. Don't confuse me with the facts. We all heard that expression a million times.
Anti-Semitism. Especially in this year.
there were a lot of efforts to say that, well, we can cure anti-Semitism by educating people. That really it's just ignorance.
Right.
But obviously that has not turned
out. So why has that not worked? So this is a very important issue. We always discuss this, is that the truth is we are on a higher standard. We are held to a higher standard than the Goyim. It may be a good answer for the Goyim why they have a right, why the United States of America doesn't bother them, their conscience, that they're living on stolen land. It doesn't bother them.
Actually,
what?
Actually, in today's Democrats, they're anti-America too, so it doesn't help. For some of those same reasons.
I'm sure those Democrats are not willing to give back their home to the local Indian who shows up, right? An Indian comes in with a big hat and say, here's my deed.
No,
here's my deed from 1,000 years ago. You're on stolen land, right? Go tell a Democrat, here you go. Get off my property.
No. They live behind the walls.
So what's the answer? The answer is, it may be a good answer. It may be a good answer for the Goyim. But the Goyim, and we also realize that we are on a higher level. We have a higher standard. In the rules of ethics, it's not black and white. It's not black and white. There are rules and standards for the Goyim, and there are higher expectations held from us. And we subconsciously, that's why I think in Eretz Yisrael, a lot of the liberals, they feel that nobility, that, you know, we're better than all of you. We're better. And therefore, indeed, we are on a higher level. We have a higher standard. And that's right. Maybe, really, we don't have a right to this territory.
Right. They believe they stole the land.
Right. Exactly. Why would they? Why? What, so
what happens,
so,
Israel happens in America. And
well,
vice versa.
It's a little different.
It's the same type of thinking.
I know. I don't think so. I mean, all right, whatever it is. But what then is the answer? If it's true that indeed we are on a higher standard, we're held to, why then indeed do we have the right to Eretz Yisrael? How do we live with it? It's not a good thing to go say, we're just like the Goyim. If the Goyim do it, so we can do it. That's a horrible, horrible thing to say. We're not like the Goyim. It's a disgusting thing. You hear this all the time. Is that, we can take money from the government. We can take all of these entitlements because the Goyim do it. If they do it, so we can do it. You know, if Rachmana Litzlan, you don't have a choice, you don't have a choice. But if you have a choice and you can do something about it, that's not an excuse. Just because they do it, we do it. You're not them. You're the Am HaNivchar. You have a higher standard in every respect. Don't take advantage. If Rahman al-Litzlan, this is what you have. No, what can you do? But Rahman, but do something for the future, not to need to be like them, to be better than them. So what then is the answer? The answer only comes down to one answer. And that answer requires a person to be a religious Jew, an Orthodox religious Jew with emunah. It's the first Rashi in Chumash, and that is, the first step is to believe, ani mamim, that it's Hashem created the world. Hashem created the world and he gave the land of Canaan to whom he saw fit. He allowed the Canaanim to occupy, to take possession. But Hashem also gave them the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, and they knew it. It's not like, oh, they were not educated, they did not know better. They did know better. Chazal made it very clear. They know there's a God. They know it just as well as we know it. They know it. And they chose to reject him. And not only they chose to reject him, they chose to rebel against him in many, many ways, in many, many forms, to the point where HaKadosh Baruch Hu was detested. The words that used in Tanakh are very powerful to describe the abominations and the degree of hate that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had for these people, who the tenants of his prime real estate. And therefore, he threw them out, legally. And therefore, we have a therefore, and Hashem gave it to us. It all comes down to that. When you live in a non-Jewish world, where people are not ma'aminim, you're talking to a wall when you make those statements. Yeah.
They don't deny that the land of Israel belongs to the Jews, but they say the Jews which are there now is not the same Jews which were these converts to Judaism.
That sounds more like a factual error.
But that's what...
That's one other argument. Like you say, don't confuse me with the facts.
Yeah.
When it comes to hatred, that's a reality. Hatred, you're totally oblivious to the facts. Love conquers all, and hatred, you ignore all. Totally ignore all. It's like someone told me he had a child, and the child was in the yeshiva, was a terror in the yeshiva. And the yeshiva did everything they could do with this child to try to work with him, not to have to throw him out of the yeshiva. But it got to a point where the kid is just impossible, and after all the warnings and azharis and everything that you can possibly do, they called in the parents and said, "Ad kan, we're throwing out your child. Your child is the worst. We have no choice. He's a very big influence on all the other students, and he's making trouble for everyone. He has to go." So the father says, "What? You're telling me that my child is not the best in the class?" It's not that the parent says, "Oh, my child, you know, I know he's a troublemaker, and I know he's the bottom of the barrel, but not you know, not the sediment, not just a little bit up. He's therefore what he's done is that." The father says, "For you to tell me anything other than he's the best, he's the Shamno Psalta of the yeshiva, to me is a chiddush." So the father is living in a world of fantasy, right? But you know something, it worked. It's amazing. The person who told me the story, it worked. The yeshiva was on edge, and they were throwing the kid out. And because the father came in with the attitude, not that the kid is the difference between a serial murderer and who knows what, but the father comes in and says, "My son, he's a Nobel Prize winner." And he really believed in the father, and he shifted the whole thing from mamish mikatz to lekatz, and he's living in fantasy world. Okay, don't confuse me with the facts. It worked. It did work, at least if they didn't throw his kid out. What?
If somebody says the most outrageous.
Right. That Rachmanos, that was Hitler Yimachshmo's propaganda. Yeah. That was his technique.
Lie.
That the bigger the lie, the more someone will believe it. The more outrageous the lie, and the more you repeat it, the more people will believe it. That's a technique. That's a psychological technique. It works. It's been proven that it works short term, but not long term. Subliminal.
You show, let's say, a rat, and you talk about not the rat. You talk about somebody
right.
else. So when you move away from the subject, you don't remember the rat. You remember the sounds.
Exactly. These are all horrible things. So, but going back to Al-Pasik, Al-Pasik is telling us something very fascinating. We drove out the Canaanim. Why did we drive out the Canaanim? Because Hashem told us to do so. That's the bottom line. Everything is said and done. All of the long laundry list of reasons of why we are entitled to live in Eretz Yisrael. The old, when everything comes down to the end, it's a religious. It comes to religion. It's Hashem's world. Hashem gave it to us, and we are entitled to it. But it's a very big condition because it does involve religion. It's a double-edged sword. We have to be worthy. And if we are not worthy, then we're no better than the Canaanim. If we're no better than the Canaanim, you don't want to work with religion. You don't want to be religious. You don't want to fulfill Hashem's, then guess what? What you have done is illegal. If you want to work in the secular world, And then they're going to make arguments against you that, no, it's illegal, it's occupation, it's this and it's that. And don't give us all of these answers because we hold you to a higher standard. We got away with it. We got lucky. We all know that. We all know things like that. There are certain people, they get away with murder, and there are other people that don't get away with murder. It's just a question of who you know, where you are, mazel. Yeah.
I just want to point out, for the first time, that not only Orthodox Jewish believers should be included, but also
Christian
believers, because in this country, the only other friends that we who support Israel have are evangelicals,
right?
And they believe the Bible. They do, and we discussed this many times before. So that's their basis.
So what Sudas here is saying he's really extending this idea to a much greater degree. At least I'm trying to read that between his words, and that is midah keneged midah. If you came into Eretz Yisrael and you drove out the Canaanim only because Hashem told you to do so, and now you are no worse than the Canaanim, your behavior, you're imitating what the Canaanim did originally. So what right do you have? What right did you have to drive out the Canaanim? It's only fair that what you did to them should be done to you. Midah keneged midah. It's a shocking thing to say, and that's how he wants to read here. It says, "Who is now in the times of Mashiach going to come back and repossess the land, take over?" It's going to be the people who went into Galus. Which people who went into Galus? The people who went into Galus as a punishment, midah keneged midah, to what they've done to the Canaanim. That's an avera, that we went into Galus because we did it to the Canaanim? Well, it all depends. If you behave like the Canaanim, then yeah, you want to follow those set of rules, you want to live in the land like the Canaanim lived in the land, so why are you better than the Canaanim? The Canaanim came before you. If you want to live in the land as a religious Jew, then that's a different story. Then indeed you're entitled. But if you're not going to live in the land as a religious Jew, you're no worse than the Canaanim, and then the Lord demands midah keneged midah, an eye for an eye. You drove out the Canaanim, you will also be driven out with such detail and precision, you'll go into exile, into the same location to where the Canaanim wound up. That's what it says. V'gulas, who's going to be the one that's going to occupy the land of Mashiach? V'golus, the exiles, hachel hazeh, of this mighty army, this mighty nation. Livnei, and now we define Livnei, the chel over here means the nation, this mighty collection of people. Livnei Yisrael, Asher Canaanim, which were exiled with the Canaanim, meaning were exiled just like the Canaanim all the way at Tsarfas. Why mention the Canaanim here? The Canaanim are long gone. We're coming here to tell you why you went into exile. Because you occupied the land illegally. It's not just Stam. He's saying this. It's a very deep idea what the Pasuk is telling us going to the Mitzudos. It's not that, okay, Hashem created the world and the land was fallow and empty and there's no one living here. And Hashem said, who will be the ones that will live in this land? The Jewish people. We come, we take possession. Now we misbehave. So Hashem says, "Well, you misbehave. Get out of here. I'm taking. I don't want. I'm going to punish you. Get out of my house." No, Hashem is not saying that. Hashem is saying is that I created the world. I gave it to someone else. If the land was empty, and I gave it to you as a present to live here, and you misbehave, I would not expel you from your home. Just because you misbehave doesn't mean that you have to be thrown out of your house. You're bad people. I'll punish you, but I'll punish you home arrest. I'll punish you in your home. You don't have to be driven out of your land. But that's not the case. The case is, I didn't give this land to you. I gave this land to someone else. The only reason why you took over this land is because you're better than those people. If you're not going to be better than those people, then just a legal matter. Then you have no right. You have no right to take possession. You never had a right to occupy this land. So get out. Get out and give it back to the people who came before you, and your punishment will be midah keneged midah. Just like you illegally evicted a tenant, so too you will also be evicted midah keneged midah. Hashem set up Eretz Yisrael in this manner in order to always keep us in check. It's an age-old question. If Hashem wanted to give Klal Yisrael Eretz Yisrael, why didn't he leave the land empty and fallow until the time of Matan Torah, until the time when we were ready, and then Hashem will bring us into a desert land, and we will nurture and develop the land and make it thrive into a holy land? Why was it necessary for Hashem to create the world in such a way where the land was first given to the Canaanim, and Hashem, when he gave us the Torah, demanded of us to drive them out, to go to war and to kill people and to drive them out? And the answer is because this will always be a stain, a permanent check and balance, a permanent way to guarantee that we behave ourselves. Because if Hashem gave us that there's an empty desert land and we misbehave, then it's not fair for Hashem to evict us from the land. Hashem has nothing over us as a way of punishing us. But because Hashem gave the land to the Canaanim, and the Canaanim misbehaved, and now we come along and we are told to drive them out because they are not worthy and we are worthy, yeah, you have to remain worthy. But if you're not going to be worthy, you're going to misbehave, you're going to be like, then you're no different than them. If you're no different than them, then in the court of law, you are illegally occupied and taken possession of a land that's not yours. And now you're going to have to suffer the consequences. And that's what the pasuk here seems to say according to the parish of the Mitzvah Stavah. That's the reason why he mentions Asher Kinanim Imitzarfas. What happened to you will be measure for measure, exactly what you did to the Kinanim who have wound up all the way in the far corners of the earth, all the way into this place called Sarfas. And just like what happened to the people of Yerushalayim, who will end up, they were driven out, and where do they find themselves? They found themselves Asher Bisfarad. Okay, Yirshu is but now in time of Mashiach, they will come back, and Yirshu is Arei HaNegev. Now, Sefarad, interesting, there are two words over here, is Tsarfas. Tsarfas, I believe, is Pravat. What is Tsarfas called today?
We call it France.
Mm-hmm. Okay, France and Sefarad, we call it Spain. It's interesting, this part really fits in very well. There is a tradition. How true the tradition is, I don't know, but I've heard this, I've read this more than once, that the Jewish people in the times of Gaulus who found themselves in Spain generally can trace their lineage to Shevet Yehuda. And the Jews who lived in Germany and France generally can trace their lineage to Binyamin. So here, it's interesting over here that we even though these words, when they were said, there was no France at this time, and there was no Spain at this time. I don't think so. Not that we know of. Going back to the time of the Bayis Rishon, when Ovadia is speaking the time of Eliyahu HaNavi, was there a country in the world called Spain and France? Not likely. And whoever was living there, if there even were people living there, it doesn't seem that studying the ancient history, it has any connection, any relationship to what today is known as Spain and France. But it's not a coincidence is that these two words that he writes, Ovadia, in the time of Eliyahu HaNavi, really have a lot of significance for us today, because in Jewish history, after the Churban Bayis, Sheni, Tsarfas, and Sepharad are two words which are major, major centers of Yiddishkeit. Okay, Rashi is the Frenchman, in the words of the Rambam. Okay, he's the Frenchman, and that is Tsarfas. And Rashi is the Rabban Shel Kol Yisrael. Unquestionably, there's no one greater, there's no one in this world that we can call a Rebbe with a title of a Rebbe other than Rashi. And who else has made one of the most major impacts in Jewish and Judaism? The Rambam. And the Rambam is Sepharad. The Rambam's main yeshiva.
Iberian Peninsula and Gaul.
Yeah.
So he identifies himself as being it's amazing here that it says the people that are going to come back and repossess Eretz Yisrael and going to conquer Edom are the students, I'm saying homiletically, of Rashi and the students of the Rambam. Those are the two major Rebbeim, major teachers that we have in Klal Yisrael. Who other than they? And you say had so much their impact, their influence on Klal Yisrael is incredible.
I'm looking at the Targum here.
Yeah.
He called it Tsarfas, okay. And Golos Mishalem Dibispamya.
Of Spamya. So he indeed calls it.
Right.
Even though when Ovadia is writing Tamil Eliyahu HaNavi, I mean there is no these plays don't really exist. Okay, so this is the basic parish of the Mitzvah Destavid. I think it's very, very deep. Let's see Rashi. Rashi, Pasachov, again, 396, Vigalus, Hechel Azet, Tirgim Yodasan, Ata, Hadain. Now, this, Hachel, Loshen Hachayil, the army. Kemo Vayavo, Yerushalayma, Bechel Kavod, with a great army, Drav Shoke. A host of people, right? That's really what it refers to. That's how we really that's how we want to use it in this context. A host of people, in Tanakh, usually the host of people are people wearing battle gear, okay, with weapons and ready to attack and destroy. But v'chelo yorav ayam. So the mark, the chariots, the power of v'chelo, his army, they were coming against Klal Yisrael to destroy us, which means they came with weapons. However, it does not seem that that's the precise meaning of the word. The word, it's a borrowed term. Chel, as you just said, means a collection, a host of people. A collection of people. People can come in peace. People can come to produce, to do something of benefit, not to destroy and kill. So here it says, Vigolus HaChel, as the Jewish people, certainly they're not in the category of an army. Klal Yisrael has never been very powerful. Not until recent times, but the chel here refers to the collection of people. Here, the Rashi is telling us, "Vegulus achel azetik minison and amo hadein." This nation, hachel, he's telling us the word chel had hachel lashon hachayil kama vayavo yushleimag bechel kovei derav shake. Rav Shake was a representative of Sancheirif. And he said blasphemous words to the Jewish people in the time of Chizkiyahu HaMelech. And I think Chazal says Rav Shake was a renegade Jew. He was originally a Jew who went off the Derech. And that's how he knew the language. He spoke to the Jewish people in Hebrew. And he scared the life out of them. Because he knew all the inside, he knew the secrets. So Rav Shake was an assistant to Sancheirif, who came against Klal Yisrael to destroy Klal Yisrael. And it says that when he arrived to Yerushalayim to terrorize the people by telling them he's going to destroy the entire Yerushalayim, it says he came with a chel gadol. Elash zechos hayud. Over here he's pointing out that here we're missing a yud. Over here the word chel does not have a yud. And there normally the word chel does have a yud. Why not? He doesn't want to tell us why. V'yeshu l'farish hachel hazeh golus hagai hazeh. It refers to the golus of Gai means the valley. The golus of Gai. So according to this interpretation, the word chel the reason why it's missing a yud is because it does not mean an army. When you have a yud and the pronunciation is chel, then obviously it means one thing, it means a host of people. And Klal Yisrael, when the time is the Mashiach, they're going to come back as a large multitude. They will return to the land. They will return to possess and occupy, to possess and conquer Eretz Edom. But in Rashi's second interpretation, the word, he takes note that there is no yud between the ches and the lamed, so it does not mean a host of people, but it means a valley. It means a region, a guy means a valley. So it means, so then the positive means vigolus hachel hazel levnei Yisrael, the exiles of the people living in this valley, the Jewish people who have been exiled to a valley. They live in Silicon Valley, somewhere in California. They live over there. Those people living in the valley will now return and possess the land. Levnei Yisrael asher b'kananim at Sarfas, golus asher hu mibnei Yisrael, shogolum yaseres ha-shvatim l'eretz kananim at Sarfas. The golus of the aseres ha-shvatim, the golus asher hu mibnei from the children of Yisrael, shogolum yaseres ha-shvatim, where did they go into golus? They went into Golus li'eretz kinanim ad sarfas. So we take note that Rashi is not like the Mitzudas. Mitzudas was much more homiletic. According to the Mitzudas, it means im ha-kinanim. The Jewish people who went into exile together with the kinanim. The kinanim went into exile, we did it to them. So now payday has come, we are going to go into exile with them. That's not what Rashi says. Rashi here is not telling us anything poetic of Mida, Keneged Mida. What we did to them is being done to us, focusing upon what happened to the Kananim. Forget about it. Right now, let's look at the facts on the ground today. Hayoim. There are parts of the world today where the Kananim live. Okay, where whatever that means. I guess when Ovadia wrote these words, Al Derech Pshat, they were still Kananim living. That's a fact. Okay, Klal Yisrael were always battling the early times of the Bayis Rishon. They were definitely still battling the Kananim. And the Kananim, most of them were exiled, took up residence outside the land in some neighboring country. Here, Ovadia says that the Jewish people who are going to go into exile and they're going to be in the territory where the Kananim are living, which means outside of Eretz Yisrael, all the way until Tsarfas, they will return. Nothing poetic, no mida keneged mida, it's nothing more than a location, a reference point to where the Jewish people will find themselves after the Churban that will come in the vision of Ovadia. And then also this, that is a silver lining in the words of Ovadia. He's coming, according to Rashi's understanding of this pasuk, there is an allusion that the Aseres HaShvatim will indeed return. This is a major machlokes in Masechta Sanhedrin Perchelik. Will the Aseres HaShvatim return to Eretz Yisrael? We are always under the assumption no, because as far as we see today in the modern world, they're gone. There's no trace of them. They disappeared how many years ago? Almost 2,700 years ago. They disappeared off the face of the earth, and there's no trace of them whatsoever. Certainly there are people who are individuals. It's not going to happen. Hashem is going to allow the 12 Shvat to totally disappear, but no one knows their true Yichus. But the vast majority of the Aseres HaShvat have disappeared. The only ones that today are left are from Yehuda and Binyamin. And here Rashi says that in the times of Mashiach, the Bnei Yisrael, who are the Bnei Yisrael? The Aseres HaShvatim. How does Rashi know that? Because there's repetition in this pasuk. The second part of the pasuk says there's the Golus of Yerushalayim. And that clearly refers to who? Yehuda and Binyamin, the only ones that remained in Yerushalayim. It has to therefore be by process of elimination, at the beginning of the pasuk that says the Bnei Yisrael has to be the Aseres HaShvatim. And here Ovadia promises that they will return. They will return, they will possess the Orei HaNegev. So let's read those words. Levnei Yisrael asher b'kananimus asher tovas kolus asher hu b'golos, the exiles asher hu that are members of Levnei Yisrael shagalu, who went into exile me aseres hashvatim. Where did they go into exile? To a part of the world where the Canaanim were living in those days, which we don't know where it is, because today we don't know of any Canaanim left. Le'eretz Canaanim, ad all the way to Tsarfas, all the way until this place called Tsarfas, France, maybe, who knows, whatever it refers to. Whatever, when he was saying these words, obviously it had a different meaning. Had a different meaning when Ovadia said the word Tsarfas. In hindsight, today we try to define Tsarfas as France, but whatever it means. V'golus Yerushalayim asher bisfarad shehei mibnei Yehuda, and the Jews who come from Sheva Yehuda asher golu lisfarad, they went to exile to Sifarad. Heim Yershu, in the times of Mashiach, they will possess this Arei Hanegev shebidroi Mashal Eretz Yisrael. Now notice he learns that this refers to Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't say they're going to inherit the Edom, the Goyim. Not like the Mitzudus that said this refers to they're going to take possession of the land of Edom. Rashi learns they're going to come back and take possession of Eretz Yisrael. And then he concludes the Oimrim HaPoisrim, the interpreters, those who want to wax homiletic, they translate Tsarfas Hu HaMalchus. What? Okay, whatever, but it has to be because when Ovadia wrote these words, al derech pshat, what was he thinking when he said Tsarfas?
He was thinking of the future.
There, I am Panim Torah. There's the future. It's definitely true, 1,000,000% true. But all the words of Nevuah are also have to be understood al derech pshat.
But this means to the ends of the earth.
Okay.
Which was the end of the dawn.
Okay, all right. So who's Tsarfas? Who Hamalchus Hazesh Shekarin Paranitsa? What's Paranitsa?
France.
Okay, France. And Sifarat, take him here, son. Aspamia, Spain. So he's thinking the Poisrim. He's thinking 1,000 years ahead. Okay, later we have to Google and learn about the ancient origins of France and Spain. When they were first recognized on the map as... That's what Michal said. But I'm saying, of course it's a Nauvoo, and of course it has to be France and Spain. But when the Navi says his words to the people at the time, it also had to make sense to them. And people living in the time of Ovadia, in the time of Eliyahu HaNavi, when they heard these two words, Tsarfas and Sifarad, so
the ends of the earth.
So they heard of it? What did it mean to them?
They changed the text?
No such thing to say that. We never heard of such a thing.
But that doesn't mean they changed the text.
There was a tradition, it was written. These were words that were written from back in the time of Eliyahu HaNavi. There were scrolls. And in the scroll it said the word Tsarfas and Sifarad. When Ovadia spoke, Nevuah was spoken. When he spoke, he said the word Sifarat. He said the word Tsarfas. And those words were put in a scroll. And years later, when it was canonized, what will be the Chof Dalet Sifrei Tanakh? This scroll was selected to be written with Ruach HaKodesh. But that doesn't mean they edited it. Chas v'shalom. That's not our tradition. There was no editing of the words to substitute new words for old words to make it sense. It was exactly the way it was said. It was the way it was put in the text. putting the cat. That's what we had last week. This long discussion. What it said in the Mincha Shai about the word Saviv. Remember that long Mincha Shai we had? It was an incredible Mincha Shai. Never something like that. Where there was a whole question of what is the connect girsa, and he said he had Gilui Eliyahu who told him that this was the correct girsa. This was the way it was originally, and it was a corruption of the text. So it's a fascinating thing. These two words, which mean quite a bit to us, okay, France and Sepharad, as because mainly because of our whole history comes from Rashi, the Tarsha Bal Peh, has been transmitted through the two Rebbeim, Rashi and the Rambam, and yet these words were already used by Ovadia. How many years before? Ovadia was in the beginning of the Bayis Sheni.
Don't we have in the Chumash
that Ovadia was the time of Eliyahu HaNavi?
Eliyahu HaNavi before the Bayis. Before.
Long before.
Sorry.
He's in Malachim.
In the beginning of Malachim. Well. So Malachim is during the time of the Bayis. What did I say? Bayis Rishon. I'm sorry. What did I say? Bayis Rishon. Bayis Rishon. Of course, the Bayis Rishon. What do I say?
The Bayis Rishon. That now is the name different.
What? Nothing changed. Everything is the same. When he said these words, so the Bayis Rishon existed for 410 years. And then there was 70 years of Golus. 420 years of the Bayis Sheni. And then there were about there were 500 years. Modern history really begins after the Dark Ages. The year 500 is approximately, am I mistaken? When we want to study world history,
There's
not much to study before the year 500. World history begins in the year, we're now 2019. The year 500 is when all the encyclopedias get very, very thick. Before the year 500, you have like a page. What happened in this 100 years? What happened in this? Oh, it's a big mystery. They're still doing digs to try to figure out what happened. Oh, we make up things. We look in Tanakh. From the time of the Churban Beis Hamikdash, for the next 500 years, I think it's called the Dark Ages, right? The dark. You know, it's dark because no one knows what happened. No one knows what happened during those 500 years.
Nobody knew how to write except us.
It was a big mystery. It's fast that during those 500 years is when the Talmud Bavli, the ultimate history happened. During those 500 years when the Talmud Bavli was put together. It was a long process, the 500 years to make the Talmud Bavli. But as far as world history, I don't think there's really, I'm sure they make up a lot of things, but there's not much to make up. There's not much to work with.
No sources.
After the year 500, wow, then everything gets really lebedic. That doesn't mean that it wasn't lebedic before 500, it just means that there were just no records. It wasn't important that people should record things, even though we know that's not true, because we know in time of Tanakh, Shlomo HaMelech, Halekoso B'Sefer Divrei HaYamim, the kings had Seferim to chronicle every little event, every little meeting, every little thing was recorded. So what happened to all those books? What happened to all those records? Gone. No one knows. They're all gone. There's a big black hole. The world somehow started from the year 500. And here we have, so go back those 500 years. Go back another 420 years. Go back another 70 years. Go back another. Let's say 300 years, and there's a man standing by the name of Ovadia, and he's talking about Spain and France. Wow. That's real prophecy, no? He's saying these two words. What do those words mean in the ears of the people who heard Ovadia say Sepharad and Tsarfas? Rashi, how often do you have a Rashi that says something like this? V'yoyim. Oh, for us, it's like, Mamish, it can't get better than this. You don't have to change the letters. The Poshim tell us that Tsarfas is France, and the Sepharad is Aspamia.
Does he agree with that? Does Rashi agree? Or is he saying,
well, if Rashi quotes it, he's been forced. They twisted his hands. Popular. They're not going to renew his contract unless he throws that into his commentary. Not likely. If Rashi is citing the Yesh, the Poshim, L'chor Rashi is giving legitimacy that there is something here to discuss, something to talk about. You want to see Rashi write this? There is a lot of speculation.
What I'm saying is he separating himself from the Torah or not?
Who did even write this? There are people who argue that Rashi, not every word in Rashi, in Nevi'im is authentic. We really don't know how much the words has been tampered with. Pseudo-Rashi. So what about this? Something like this, V'yesh poishim. It's not as Rashi's sprach to say this. V'yesh poishim. How often does Rashi use that term? V'oimrim ha-poishim. It's not from Rashi's vocabulary to talk like that. So right away it's suspicious. Did Rashi write this? Did an editor add this into the text? I don't know, not clear at all. The only thing that we really hold strong is the Rashi and Chumash. Rashi and Chamishi, Chumash, Torah, and even that, there are a lot of problems. But Rashi on Nevi'im and Ksuvim, there's always discussion, is it pure Rashi, or has it been manipulated by the editors over the generations?
Okay. But Rabbi, not being able to understand a contemporary person and having it come in the future is a very common thing. If you read something like Rav Kook, very hard to figure out what he's saying.
No one understands the word he said. The only one who understood what he wrote was the Nazir.
But it's more likelihood in another generation is that it'll be very clear to somebody.
That's prophecy.
Yeah.
That's prophecy. The Rav Kook, the Ma'orot, correct? The Ma'orot?
Yeah.
So the Ma'orot is one of the most mystical svarim there is today.
Right.
It's a closed book for most people. It's heavy, heavy, heavy stuff. What Rav Kook was, Ein Adam Yoreh L'Soif Dai, like Rav Meir. In the Talmud, the Gemara says, we don't pass like Rav Meir. He's always right. Rav Meir is always right. Problem is, the average man cannot relate to him. Torah was given to the masses. And the average person has to be able to understand. And Ein Adam Yoreh L'Soif Dai. But don't think just because you don't understand doesn't mean he's wrong. He knows. They say the same thing about Rav Kook. They say he knows he was right. It's just unfortunately his brilliance, his depth was so deep. Ain Adam Yoreh L'Soif Dai.
Yeah, but people using words or expressions or places which don't know what it is, but the Torah has it. They inherit it, like the European, the Jews come from the eastern part of Europe. You say you will be exiled to Siberia, they are afraid. Because you know what is Siberia?
You
want to put somebody like into place.
Yeah.
He says you're going to go to Siberia.
Well, today we know it's Siberia. I mean, it's a modern term.
In terms of a threat.
Okay, so this so saying it's threatening language, but you have to know what Siberia is. Today we know in Siberia the torture. We know that Siberia is a torture chamber. We know where it is because they actually do it. It's a real place on the map, and people were tortured.
100 years ago, the Jews which were living there was Siberia.
That's my fault.
It has to be that there was a pshutoy shel mikra. For the word Sarfas and the word Sepharad, when Ovadia said these words, these are words of prophecy. That's why we have it. That's why we learn it, because he was talking to us. And for us, wow, we know exactly what he's referring to. That when Mashiach will come, who will be the ones that will take back Eretz Yisrael? It will be the survivors of France and Spain. What about Germany? What about Poland? What about America? What about Australia? What about all the other yeshuvim? When the President of the United States, when he makes a speech, and he talks about, let's say there's a war, there's a coalition, everyone's coming together to go and do something in Syria or in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and he leaves out one country, they go berserk. Once, I think, who was it? Was it Obama? Maybe it was Bush? He spoke about the coalition were going to fight, and he left out Canada. He spoke about Germany, and he gave a long laundry list of the names of the countries that have participated, and he accidentally forgot to mention Canada. Canada sent 5 planes to help out, to refuel something, and he didn't say Canada. When he made his presentation, he never heard the end of it. They went berserk. Remember the news? They were so insulted. The people, they're sitting there, how come you left us out? How come you didn't say the word Canada? You couldn't say, take a second? And he had to apologize. I remember this. This is a couple of years ago. Remember something like this? He had to apologize, of course, whatever. It was just an oversight. It means a lot. You know, I work sometimes with Torah Anytime, and they do live events, and it baffles me that, like, you know, they do an event, and sometimes they give credit, they give a yashar koyach to this one and to this one, and it's amazing the credits. It's just to say the person's name. You don't have to elaborate eloquence. And give a hesped, a lebedik a hesped, just to say the name of a person who did something very small. It's incredible. The reaction, and then the jealousy. Why him? Why not him? Why not that one? It opens up a world that you would never ever think is possible, would happen. You never would anticipate the reaction of mentioning someone's name and omitting someone's name. You left out this, you mentioned 3 people and didn't mention him, you'll never hear the end of it. And the fact that you didn't mention this person, he's forever indebted to you. He sends in a check to the organization for $1,000. It's incredible. It's just not to be believed. And the person sitting there, you would never, ever, ever know. So here, take this a step further. We're dealing here with Kibbutz Goliath. Kibbutz Goliath. And Ovadia saying, who's going to merit Kibbutz Goliath? 2 countries. Rashi, right? The Oimrim HaPoisrim. I got only 2 Poisrim. The people, the Golus, Yerushalayim Asher Bisforat, and the beginning, and the Golus of Lubnei Yisrael Asher Kenanim at Sarfas. France and Spain. You know what you're doing over here? You know how many people you're insulting? The only one, Moiser Nefesh, died al Kiddush Hashem in every other. What about the Germany? What's going on over here?
If it's metaphorically speaking of the ends of the earth, yeah. If the ingathering is from the ends of the earth, then it certainly is coming from those places not nearly as far as the ends of the earth.
Yeah, Beryl Wine mentions in Yonah that when he ran away till the end of the end of the earth, he wanted to go down the Mediterranean. He speculates it means till Gibraltar, because that was the end of the earth.
So now you're saying a pshat. You're saying a pshat, but here's the difficulty. So now we're shifting gears. Until now we started, there's only one pshat. Okay. The only one pshat is Imos HaMashiach. He was saying prophecy, what's going to be Imos HaMashiach?
Okay.
Now we're saying, no, it can't be that, because we're talking about, he's talking in his day, the end of the civilized world ended in these 2 spots. Okay, there was a civilized world beyond these 2 locations. Who knows? Aliens living in the Far East. No one even, who knows what was going on over there. The end of the civilized world ended with this place called Sepharad and Sarfas. Okay, fine. It can mean has a lot of meaning, which is accurate and precise. But we got a problem still. Because since this is Nevuah, and since today, in hindsight, we look at this as a reference to Yimos HaMashiach, and Rashi legitimizes that approach by telling us the survivors from Sarfas, France, and from, I was very happy because Rashi came from France. Right? Rashi came, even though Rashi went to learn, Rashi's education was primarily in Germany. Rashi was made. Rashi was you know, he had a stamp on him, made in Germany. Rashi was a product of Germany, even though he came from France. And he went back to France to spread Torah. And Rashi there says, he's very happy, Rashi. I'm sorry for us. But if in hindsight we're looking at this as a revelation of Yimos HaMashiach, we're very insulted. because there are many other nations. And what about today? Today, Spain and France are not players. They're not players. They're not major players anymore. On the physical, in a...
France has the third largest Jewish population in the world.
France today has the third largest population of Jews in the world.
Largest in Europe.
Large in Europe?
No, except for the United States and Israel. France is third.
Okay, as far as numbers, and what about Spain? What about Spain today? Not on the map. Okay, even Jews in France, I'm not chashon putting anyone, but you don't hear that the centers of Klal Yisrael, there are big numbers and there are very great people in France, not, but you don't hear that France is the center of Judaism today. There are Jews living in France, Baruch Hashem, but where is who's calling the shots? Until recently, it was the United States. It was the Judaism in the United States that set the tone and called the shots for the entire world. Not anymore so much. Now it's shifted to Eretz Yisrael.
It seemed like they're the center of anti-Semitism.
France now, yeah, absolutely. But who called the shots? Until I would say 10 years ago, maybe more, maybe 20 years ago.
Before the war.
What? Before the war was Poland. Before the war was definitely Poland. Poland, Russia, and Russia, they were suppressed. It wasn't the ones who had freedom. Who had freedom? Who had the most freedom? That's the one, that's where you had influence. Hungary? Maybe, I don't know, to a degree. Jews in Hungary had a lot of freedom. But probably Poland was probably one of the major centers of Yadus and Klal Yisrael. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't, but then after the war, there's no question that America is where all the action was. There was a Yishuv, don't get me wrong, in Eretz Yisrael, the Gedolei Yisrael, the Chazonish and other, but America was a powerhouse, major powerhouse of influence of religious Jewry. Today, Eretz Yisrael definitely has become the center, without question. Without question, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Yisrael, that's where it belongs. That's where it belongs, and that's where it has returned.
So, but now, maybe since it is on the war, now the Jews are separated into groups, Sephardim and Ashkenazim. So maybe this is what he says.
So you want to say the word Sarfas, a code word for Ashkenazim, and the word Sephardim as a code word for Sephardim. What about the Yemenites? They'll be very insulted. What about the Yemenites are not Sephardim, they're a different min. The Yemenites are insulted if you call them Sephardim. Okay, you can't call Yemen a Sephardi. And besides, the Eda HaMizrach, is that, they're not real Sephardim either. They're not, that's really more of a mix. That's not, it's a different min. It's also a whole. It's, like I said, if you give credits to someone and you leave someone out, boy, are you in trouble. Are you in trouble? I know firsthand. Yeah, last night I was working for Tarni Time. We left out someone, got into so much trouble. One very important person's name was left out by mistake. You get into a lot of trouble. So you look at this pasuk over here, talking about Mashiach coming and where we would come, who's giving credits to you, leaving out. And today, they're not major players. I mean, anyone hears me say that, I'll be very insulted, but Spain and France is not major players. So how do we relate to this today? Mi bojon se. I guess we'll see tomorrow. The other mefarshim. Right, so that's the pshat, like we said originally. This is like the ancient civilization. It works out very well when you want to learn this pasuk according to the pshat level, on top of Avadya. So you have to assume that this was where the ancient civilization came to an end. Very good. Maybe it was precise at that moment in time. But if you want to say that it's a nevuah, as it is a nevuah, and the word sefarat and Sarfas is a reference to Yemos HaMashiach that we're living in today, you're leaving out quite a bit of people who are very, very insulted. So then, what is Rashi doing? What is Rashi doing when he says this? Yemos HaPoistrim, it refers to Spain and France. Why only these two? You want to say that there are Rebbeim, the Rambam, I told the Rambam. You're selecting the Rambam and Rashi, well, what about all the Chachmei, all the Chachamim Eretz Yisrael, all the Chacham who lived in Tzfas?
Yeah.
K-
Okay, they had major influence, major impact in Yadlis. What about the people in Poland? They all said major Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, the Ramah, the Beis Yosef, who lived in Eretz Yisrael. And what about the Rav Moshe Isserles? And what about all the Gedolim in Poland who mamas shaped Klal Yisrael? We said that. That's Pshat in the Talmud of Avadia. But there's Nevuah. And Nevuah is also speaking to us. And as I said, Rashi emphasizes that. That has to also be understood on that level. We're talking about Yemos HaMashiach. And Yemos HaMashiach was saying, who's going to be the primary people who are going to return from Gaulis? France and Spain.
Look at Radak,
okay, we didn't do it yet. Radak is going to a whole new place. Going to Bayit Sheni. Radak
introduces two
Right, that's a whole right. We're going to come because Radak is to modern times. Radak is this pick up on Rashi. The point of us making is that when you give a list of nations and you leave out, we know as a fact it's very problematic. So on the one hand, you're going to tell me the Pshat over here is Alderch Pshat, it's the end of the world in times of Eliyahu Navi. Fine. But it's a Nevuah, and Rashi's telling us a Nevuah. But why only to give honorable mention to these two countries and to the people whom they have produced? There were Gedolei Yisrael throughout the entire world, and that's why this needs more discussion. Let's take a short break. How are you? Baruch Hashem, good. Baruch Hashem. Were the Jews living in Holden Kush?
The point that Rashi leaves out, the Kuzaris, Rashi Norba, the Kuzaris, and Kuzar, that was a Semitic nation, that's what they say, the Arab, that they are, this European Jews, the Semitic. They were very military people, they were on the border, Russia, the Russian the kings were employing the Kuzarim and the Semitic mercenaries to protect. So this was Russia was never occupied by the Mongols very deep. From this, they were and some say that the Kazakhs is descended from
Kazakhs.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, but the time of the, when the Sefer was written, they were almost. Not converted completely, but if you read the Kuzar, the king wanted to convert. So in connection with Russia,
that was way back.
After Russia, or before Russia. So in the same way Russia. So Russia would have known about them and he left them out. So maybe he didn't know Rashi about other Jews, this is why he left out. He didn't know about the Ethiopians, most definitely didn't know about the Middle East, from the Central Asia.
I don't know. Did he say it? No one said that. Did he say it? I don't know. I don't think he said it. Whoever was inside of it, just like, when did they write the Megillah? But they wrote it 2 years after that. Right, because they originally wrote it, and then they wrote it afterwards. The right of they wrote the road. Who wrote it? How many years were they there? Do you think they have a cheer issue?
When did you come? What were they up to when you came?
Eating.
Did anyone speak by the Kiddush? Did someone speak by the Kiddush? I remember. When you came, there was no speaking? Oh, had I known, I would have come over to you. There's a big olam there. There are two offers. Two. A double header. Catnan and Camelar. Camelar. Henoch Camelar. Henoch Camelar's son. To Ackerman. Chaim Berliners. Two Chaim Berliners. The whole Chaim Berlin came. All came. The same as the whole Chaim Berlin. All the brass, the heavy brass came. They came at the end. They didn't come davening. I don't know. They finished davening about 11:15.